Well, when you headed out to come to church today, I wonder if you had in mind that you would arrive to, you know, were your expectations that this would be a peaceful and harmonious environment that you arrive to? And keep the next answer to yourself, just, you know, in your own mind. Or did you head out thinking with some trepidation and caution that actually, as you arrive here tonight, there may be conflict? But there could be tension. There might even be live disputes that you have to navigate by having come to a church event. Now, if we had time to do a little straw poll, that would be an interesting health check on a church, wouldn't it? But let me tell you, this guy on screen, his name's Tim Dyer. Tim's a friend of mine. He lives in Tasmania. But before COVID, he was travelling across Australia and across Southeast Asia as a conflict consultant to both large businesses and to churches. And he's an interesting guy, qualified in both the academic kind of expectations you would want from someone in this role, but also as a theologian and a psychologist. He's a really interesting package, and a guy who's now spent over 25 years helping to broker peaceful outcomes in both business communities and church communities. I like to call him the dispute doctor. And I think he's earned that kind of title. He doesn't call himself, that's not his card, right? But that's how I think of Tim. Get this, Tim says from his extensive experience as a conflict consultant with churches, he says, Christian congregations are more prone to conflict than any other group on the planet. Just take that in for a moment. Now, if you want to know Tim's reasons why, you have to sign up for about 12 sessions on the internet, I think, or something, or pay big dollars for him to consult or go to his conference. But he has slipped me the answers if you want to check them out later. But irrespective of that, that's not quite my point tonight. The thing is, Tim goes into places like churches where people are at each other's throats, and he knows how to both diagnose the difficulty and make prescriptions for the remedies. I mean, it's a big statement, don't you think? Christian congregations are more prone to conflict than any other group. I mean, is he seeing the Hawthorn Football Club this past week? Just ask our friend Steve. That's pretty conflicted and all over the kind of internet and TV. What about the enmity during the pandemic between our state governments and our police in Canberra? I mean, flexing the muscles of federation has involved an enormous amount of damaging slander and all sorts of conflict. Surely those people are prone. Well, let's take it a little more seriously. What about when we survey international news and you look at conflicts at a national and international level? What about somewhere like Myanmar, where we've got a military coup, severe injustices towards the citizens of that country? You want to look at high-level conflict? Are Christian churches really cauldrons of conflict? Is Tim right? And if so, what advice do the scriptures have for us on how to make peace, not war, when we're in church together? James chapter 4 happens to address this issue, so you might like to have a look at it. Maybe we're harmonious now, but let's get, you know, well equipped for other times that may be ahead as we go. Let's have a look at chapter 4 together, because to kick off, James is going to talk about diagnosing the root cause of conflict. Verses 1 to 6, those conflicts and disputes among you, where do they come from? Do they not come from your cravings that are at war within you, he says? You want something and you do not have it, so you commit murder. And you covet something and cannot obtain it, so you engage in disputes and conflict. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and you do not receive because you ask wrongly in order to spend what you get on your pleasures. Now, James, if you know a bit about the Bible, was no stranger to brokering peace where conflict arose in the church. In fact, if you have a look at Acts chapter 15, you'll see that James steps up to bring peace in the midst of the conflict when Gentiles, non-Jews, started to receive all the benefits of the gospel to the great chagrin of the Jewish community in the early days of the church. And like an early dispute doctor himself, James in this letter has already taught us that if God's wisdom is the source of our thoughts and words and actions, we should see as a result in our communities kind words, humble attitude, and consistent acts of mercy from the church's members. If God's wisdom is at work within them, he says. So it's pretty much our last three sermons kind of drawn together, really. But of course, among some of James' first readers, as we see here in chapter 4, there must have been pretty serious fights and quarrels going on. They were both verbal and violent by the kind of language that's used in the original text. And rather than pointing to the particulars of their wrongdoing, although in chapter 5 we will focus in on an example of the kind of conflict that were in these churches, but you'll have to come back to church for that, James diagnoses, instead of looking at particulars, the root cause of all conflicts in the church from his point of view. What is that root cause? Well, there's a clue again in the original language, but it's certainly pointed to at verse 6 as well. In verse 1, James uses a word from which we get our English word, hedonism. And you heard the hint of where it's all going on in verse 6 when it talks about wanting to get things for your own pleasure. He points to the human penchant for personal pleasure, for self-aggrandizement, the insatiable desire to acquire. These are signs, James says, not of God's wisdom at work, but of something that a deeper diagnosis must bring to light. Before we close in a little bit more on that, have a look at the three likenesses James gives to those Christians in conflict. Verse 2, he pretty much says, you're like murderers. Now, some biblical scholars think this letter comes later in history, at a time when the Romans are violently persecuting Christians and there's zealots like those in the old Jewish days, like the Maccabees. But as we've looked closely at the letter in our series, this is probably more akin to Jesus' teaching, because James is so right into Jesus' teaching in the Gospels. And Jesus, remember, made the link in Matthew chapter 5 to 7, as you look at the Sermon on the Mount, between what you think in your mind or your heart and what happens in ultimate action. So he makes the link, doesn't he, of saying even anger towards a brother or sister has the same kind of DNA as acts of killing. So the kind of quarrels and verbal violence and even flexing of power in these churches, he likens to killing. Look at verse 4. He calls them adulterers. Now you can imagine in some times and places how preachers have taken this word and gone to town. But when we think of the way prophets like Jeremiah spoke of the people of Israel in days old when they abandoned the covenant God had made with them, they too were regarded as adulterers because of their unfaithfulness to God. And how did Jeremiah discern their unfaithfulness to God? By how they treated both the land and the people who were poor among them. By their self-aggrandizement, their self-satisfying ways. They were labelled as adulterers in that case. And James is, of course, writing to people who are originally from a Jewish background, who've become Christians. This kind of makes sense of verse 4 to me. And then also in verse 4, did you note that James calls these violent verbalists in the church friends of the world and therefore not friends of God? Now, James is not calling us to be heading off to the monasteries, withdrawing from any engagement with the marketplace. What is he talking about when he talks about friends of the world? In the early 1900s, a question was raised in a newspaper called The Times in London. You may have heard of it. And it was an interesting proposal in the early 1900s. Just one single question was raised for which correspondents could send in their answer. The question was, what is wrong with the world? And one writer sent in the following response. It said, "Dear sir, I am." And that writer was one G.K. Chesterton. Just do a little, you know, Google on that name later after the service. "Dear sir, I am. What's wrong with the world?" I remember having to confront a church member a long, long time ago in a galaxy far away, in a church that was in that galaxy, long before I arrived here. And I had to take another member of the church with me to meet with a particular member of a church committee who consistently, even after appeals from various members of the church, would send hurtful, threatening and divisive emails zinging around the committee day and night, quite violent verbiage going on. I realised after we spent time talking with this member of the church, it was in, I think, about above the 30th floor in a really swank CBD building, I realised for this particular gentleman, his behaviour on email was perfectly normal and acceptable in his workplace. And it hadn't occurred to him that to bring that kind of power struggle into a church committee might at all be wrongdoing. No wonder in this letter James has to spend so much time teaching about the power of the tongue, the power of speech, the power of the written word, and how when used violently, when used to exercise power over others, it divides, it derides, it destroys. No wonder he had to appeal to a different wisdom other than the wisdom of what's the worst about the world. And that's the point James is really getting at here. So, having diagnosed at the heart of all conflicts in the church, perhaps, the self problem that's going on in human beings, what remedy does the dispute doctor recommend? We know that Jesus taught what James is teaching here. He taught to us that destructive self-seeking words and actions originate in what he called the heart of a human being. The very centre of oneself. Have a look at Matthew chapter 15, verse 19 sometime. You'll see a summary of Jesus' theology of this kind of behaviour emerging from within. For the heart is where the Gospels tell us we most need the transforming power of God to be at work through the death of God's only Son, Jesus, our Lord. To produce a peaceable church, James says, God's wisdom must be allowed to do its work on the inside. Let's have a look at the next part of the text. Dispensing the right medicine, verses 7 through 12. It says, "Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning, and your joy into dejection. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you. Do not speak evil against one another, brothers and sisters. Whoever speaks evil against another or judges another speaks evil against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you're not a doer of the law, but a judge. And there is one lawgiver and judge who is able to save and destroy. So who then are you to judge your neighbor?" A young man once visited this guy, a famous 16th century preacher and reformer known as Martin Luther. This young man was so constantly plagued by wrongful desires, by lustful thoughts within, he thought, "I'll go and see the preacher." And he asked Martin Luther, "What should I do with these inner wrongful motives?" Martin Luther's reply was typically blunt and pithy and to the point. He said, "You can't stop birds flying to and fro in the air, but you can stop the birds from nesting in your hair." And this is important for us when we tackle the idea of so-called curing conflict in places like churches. My friend Tim would say that in the last 10 to 15 years, conflict theory has moved from a cure to a management of conflicts. And it seems to me that James was already onto this long, long ago. He wants us to be best prepared for the inevitability of temptations and conflicts arising regularly in such a diverse collective as a community like a church. Conflict is going to arise again and again and again. That should probably be our expectation in the church. But what do you need in terms of inner preparation and wisdom from God to be able to address every occasion and not let those birds nest in your hair, but keep flying to and fro and respond differently? That's a really important point for us to think about. So it's not really a couple of jabs and you're safe, right? You know, just 12 weeks apart, if you have the AC like I did. But we're not really talking about a cure from James chapter 4 so much as ongoing therapy that comes from following Jesus and receiving the grace that God abounds in giving. And here's the key ingredients from what could be a long Bible study, because it's really tricky verses, and we can do that another time. But I've given you 4 R's that I think make a good response for a good remedy that keeps being applied. The implication in the Greek is ongoing application, not a one-off cure, not a couple of jabs, okay? James says something like this: relinquish your need for power. You notice there's a quote from Proverbs in there: God humbles the proud. And we hear him throughout this letter, God exalts the lowly. We hear that in the Apostle Paul. We see it alive in Jesus' teaching and example. Relinquish your need for power over others and over God. That's the only way, with God's help, to overhaul the consistent root cause of conflict that could be described in that hedonistic manner that James does in the first 6 verses. Secondly, reject destructive patterns that cause strife, the ones that you've learned quite well in other places. It's really important that you see the outcomes of your thoughts, words and actions and honestly ask, as James has equipped us, is God's wisdom at work here? Or is it something else? And how can I now tap in to what God says is available to me by grace? Thirdly, reflect deeply on the benefits of knowing Christ, verses 9 and 10. It's a curious verse. He says, a lot of laughter going on. I really want you to be sad, to start mourning and lamenting. Remember, he's so into Jesus' teaching. Blessed are those who truly mourn, for they shall be comforted. I think the idea here is really take time to reflect deeply, penitently, upon what it means to have been self-centered at the core and what a blessing it is to be given a new self that is fashioned by Christ, whose love seeks the benefit of others. And fourthly, really tough words in verse 11 and 12. We've got to decide to not get in the way of God's grace. We have to refrain from putting ourselves as the judge over others. So it's easy, just put those 4 R's into action and you'll be okay. Well, good luck with that, without knowing that God has actually provided what we need to walk this pathway towards more peaceable community. St. Augustine of Hippo wisely said, God gives what God demands of us. And if you go back and read this text, James is really confident of that. Grace abounds. More and more grace is given, he says, in the center of this passage we're studying. Because we'll need it. Whenever temptations that lead to conflicts come our way, James wants us to lean on our ever-present God. Come near to God, God will draw near to you, he says. I don't know whether you caught on the Olympics coverage today an interview with Jess Fox, who won gold in the turbulent waters sitting in that small kayak. In her interview, she constantly talked about her team that was behind her success. Now, they weren't in that small boat with her, but she spoke as if they really were, as if they were right at hand every metre of the journey. James has that kind of idea for us as disciples of Christ. By God's wisdom, we know it's synonymous with God's Spirit in the letter of James. God is ever present, ready to give grace where it's needed. Through Jesus, we also know evil is ultimately defeated on the cross. So there's no need for us to allow it to have the upper hand, or at least not to be given free rein by our participation. Instead, James wants us to shut that gate and open the door to God every time. At the beginning of this short talk, I asked you, when you set off tonight, were you expecting it would be a peaceful evening with your church friends? Or did you have some caution and anxiety about whether there might be some turbulence and turmoil? James would ask you every time you set out to a church event to think of yourself as one of the makers of peace and to draw upon the grace that is so readily provided in and through Jesus Christ to people of faith. To lay aside your want to rule over others, to put aside your need for your own pleasure at the expense of others, to deeply appreciate the benefits of Christ that are promised to us, and lastly, to become more and more a person who encourages, who blesses, and who promotes peace towards others. Let's pray.